Hello and welcome to an Earth First radio special. Today we present the history of Earth First. This was presented around a campfire at the 2005 Round River Rendezvous in the Northern Cascades of Oregon. This program will be presented in four parts, and this segment is part two.
There's one action that, I think it was 1986. I'm not exactly sure of the year, but it was not a civil disobedience. Do people know about the Barstow to Vegas race? That are, you know, these dirt bikers that go from Barstow in California across the desert to Las Vegas through the desert tortoise habitat and just tear up the desert. And it's on BLM land, and they were just allowed to do this year after year after year with BLM's blessing, and people hadn't been able to stop it. It was kind of difficult to protest because you have, you know, hundreds of big, burly fucking motorcycle riders, you know, just careening through the desert, hippie-hating motorcycle riders. And the Sahara Club was involved in this, too. And if people know the Sahara Club, they don't seem to be as visible or active these days, but they've had quite the anti-Earth First agenda in years past, where they would publish newsletters with people's license plate numbers and stuff like that, and really targeted people and put out these newsletters saying, okay, you know, here are these license plate numbers, go out with your baseball bat and hunt these people down. And they were visible in Redwood Summer, and they went up to the North Coast and did dirty tricks workshops with the people up there that were trying to stop the protest. So they were involved with this motorcycle race. So we decided to protest this motorcycle race, not with a civil disobedience, but with a blockade that would actually stop the race, if only for a period of time. And so we came up with this scheme. It goes across this great expanse of desert, but the interstate runs through there, too. And there's two places where the race has to go underneath Highway 15. There are these tunnels. They're like these square tunnels that go underneath the interstate because the motorcycles can't cross the interstate. It's just big old freeway. So we came up with this idea to put a blockade in the tunnel, and it basically was a tunnel plug. It was a little difficult to design, but we did it with found materials with a bunch of railroad ties and pieces of plywood and rebar. It was a pretty small group of us, and we went down there, and we got all these materials together and went out to this old landfill site, and after dark put it together and drilled holes in the railroad ties, then brought all the material there, and at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and so here we are underneath the freeway putting together this plug, and it was, I don't know, like maybe 10 feet by 10 feet, maybe a little bit bigger than that. But it had to be a solid plug. And so it took quite a bit of construction. And so we were there for like 5 hours, like pounding rebar, and at some point realized that there's hundreds of these dirt bikers camped out all over the desert, all around. And we're there like pounding rebar. And it was interesting because it brought out these quirks in people's personalities. I mean, if they had any tendencies towards paranoia, and those people will go unnamed. But actually, this action, because it wasn't a CD, it was under wraps for years. We put it together, and it was quite solid. We left. It was actually just before dawn. It was just getting light. The whole thing took a lot longer than we thought it would, and so we skedaddled out of there, and we had to, like, run across, I don't know, it was about a mile and a half, 2 miles of desert, with all of these motorcyclists sleeping, and they're sleeping bags, trying to be quiet, getting out of there. Then the race started in the morning, and our final little piece de resistance in the plug was, there was this guy who is the head of the Sahara Club and actually had been kind of the driving force behind the anti-Earth First campaign that they had going. His name was Rick Simons. He was called the Duck. This was his nickname, was the Duck. We took these roofing nails, you know, that have the big head, and in the bottom piece of railroad tie, we nailed in, "Fuck the Duck." it just so happened that when the race began, because he was just so closely tied to this race, you know, this race was his baby in many ways, that he was like the leader of the race. And so it just so happened that when they found the plug, he was the first person in the race and came upon it. And we were like up in this hillside kind of watching over, and he was just jumping all over the place, and he really flipped out. Anyway, it stopped the race. And
well, okay, this is, I don't know if there's any rules here, but this is like after gathering action thing. Nevada test site, it's like my second year into like the front lines activism, and technically at that point I was Seeds of Peace, but now I'm just friends of Seeds of Peace. I sleep on their couch. But anyway, so it was after everything was over, and we're being obvious. We have this, we provide the kitchen, and, well, we didn't help plan the action because we're not allowed to do that, according to the federal government. Individuals might have done something. But anyway, so we were obvious. We had the bus with all the wrong bumper stickers on the back, and a trailer of shitters, and the brown truck, and Grumbles, who's here, bottom line, in the kitchen, he was in the brown truck behind us. We stopped in this tiny little town. We're heading to Vegas, trying to get home. Flagstaff was home at that point in time. One of the guys, Doug, comes up to me in this little gas station we stopped at. It's like, the cops are kind of looking at our tags. So they're pulling us over. Grumbles is behind us in the brown truck. They pretty much told him, go back to the brown truck. Can't be here. So there's like 8 to 12 of us. And actually, I think Hunter was in the bus with us. So the driver, who we'll call Oliver, is like, we're getting pulled over. He throws the bowl back, and I catch it and zip it into the pillow. He's like, I think that's pretty safe. And, yeah. And so we're stopped. We're getting up to get out. And this belligerent cop yells through the window, put your hands on your head and come out or we might have to shoot. And, you know, me with cops, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. If you're going to be an asshole, I'll be an asshole. Yeah. So me and Doug just decided to play the asshole. And, yeah. And there's like 4 cop cars pulled us over. We harassed him so much within the first few minutes. This one cop got in his car and drove off and gave us a finger. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I'm like, you cannot search this bus, and I'm doing my routine, and even if you think you can, they're like, welcome to Nevada, you got no rights, and they're like, okay, we know what we're dealing with. Me and Doug and the rest of them were harassing, they're like, you know, they don't understand, none of them understand, because they're trained in a certain way, trained to think a certain way, like, who owns a bus? We're like, we do. They're like, who owns a bus? Collective Seeds of Peace. And they're getting pissed off. Who owns a bus? We do. And then they hesitated and they thought, and they're like, oh, okay, try another question. Yeah. And so they're like, okay, who was driving? Oliver was driving. And he's got his 3-year-old kid, and he used to play cop games, hide from the cop. Yeah. You know. And so the cops are like, you need to come over here, but you need to hand off your kid to somebody. You know, these are like the evil mafia cops, you know, kind of like Chicago cops or San Francisco. Anyway, so like, you need to hand off. He's like, no, I'm not handing off my kid to anybody. And they kept saying it like 3 times. I guess 3 is the number for them. Anyways, they finally like, okay, don't blame us if you drop your kid. And me and Doug are going nuts. What are you going to do to make him drop the kid? And he's like, you just pulled us over for the bumper stickers because we have the shitters. They're like, no, we didn't. Yeah, no. And so he goes over and, you know, things, and this cop comes up, and I'm kind of up on the hill. I got the high ground. Cop comes up behind me and jacks my arm way up my back. And I was like, how the hell are you justifying this? And I didn't know he pulled my license out of my pocket, pickpocketed me while he had my arm up my back. And he's like, you didn't follow my order. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you don't have your hands on top of your hands. I was like, oh, look at our friend. I didn't want to say it. There's our friend, like, wandering all over the place. Another cop's going, stand right here. And she's just silent, not getting them shit. She's moving around. No, stand right here. I mean, they lost complete control. She stood for like 2 seconds and then kept wandering around. So the punchline is the state cop rolls up. So this is 4 cars again, about 5 cops. And we had them outnumbered. Anyway. This big belly of a cop. He's just like, we didn't know he could move that fast. He, like, as fast as he can, comes up to Doug, and he's, like, leaning over him. And it was so intense that neither one of them realized I'm about 2 inches away from them with a Sharpie writing the cop's name and badge number on my arm. And he just, like, goes into this rant. He's like, I didn't go to Vietnam so you could protest. And Doug is just kind of like this. The guy's like that. Doug is like kind of just taking it. He's like, waiting. And the guy just runs out of steam, you know. You know, there's silence. And Doug goes, U.S. Army honorable discharge. It was like the knockout punch. The guy, you could just see him, like, sway back. He was like, what? You know, it was all over. I was like, you did pull us over for the bumper stickers. You did. And he's like, no, it was a cracked windshield. Oh, that's funny. The other cops said it, the license didn't match. That's the story.
I'll tell you about the Buffalo Guts. So we got the idea that we needed to make a really, really colorful presentation to the Secretary of Agriculture because he was coming out to Montana to see what the situation was down on the ground. And so earlier in the year, we had driven up to this event in Yellowstone. We decided we wanted some Buffalo Guts because you never know when you might need 5 gallons of Buffalo Guts. And I was dressed in my Carhartts, and we were in this big old F-250 pickup truck that earlier in the year we'd hauled a bunch of hay up to feed the buffalo up to Yellowstone Inn. And we got out, and we asked the cops if we could have some buffalo guts, and they said, oh, no, we're not done with this pile yet. You'll have to come over here. And they drove us over to this other big old pile of buffalo guts, and they gave us 5 gallons of buffalo guts, and we put it in our bucket and drove off. And so we didn't know what we were going to do with it. We decided one day that we needed to talk to the governor. So what do you do when you need to talk to the governor of Montana? I called him on the telephone and left a message. And about 9 o'clock at night, we're hanging out and everything. And the phone rings. I pick it up, and it's like, this is Governor Roscoe. So we set up a meeting with him, and we had this little container of buffalo guts, little, like, I don't know, gallon freezer bag of buffalo guts. And we took it up to his office and everything, and he's talking in circles and going on about hyperbole and all this stuff. And finally, I said, well, you know, this is what we think the problem is. And I whipped out this bag of buffalo guts. And his secretary ran in and said, this interview is over with. And no mainstream environmental group would talk to us after that. We're watching the news one night, and we hear that Dan Glickman, Secretary of Agriculture, is going to come down to a Gardner, Montana, to find out what the situation is on the ground. And it occurs to us that we have this now, you know, months have passed, and we didn't store these buffalo guts anywhere but in the barn. And yeah, we didn't even open them up. So we decide we're going to drive down there, and we're going to take these buffalo guts with us. You know, I have to tell you, we have a history of poorly planning actions where we think we should get away. And you know, we always sit around afterwards and go, yeah, you're supposed to get away when you do this stuff. We're not good at it. But so we drive down, and they're having this public meeting, and Conrad Burns is there. He is the United States Senator from Montana, one of two. And so Max Baucus, the other bookend, is there. And Roscoe's there, the governor of Montana at the time, now head of the RNC, I think. I don't know what he's doing, but I'm sure it's foul, and he talks a lot. And Dan Glickman's there. Dan Glickman's one security guy is there because he was supposed to have two, but the dude missed the plane in Denver. So there's one Secret Service agent there with Glickman. And we decide that Roscoe's talking in circles, and he's about got the audience to sleep. We think we had a positive outcome in this story because we're in the public participation part, and somebody asked a question, and they directed I think it was a plant from the other side. They directed the question at Roscoe because they knew Roscoe would go on for 35 minutes making introductory remarks. And Delilah decides that she knows what she wants to do with these buffalo guts. And so we go out to the car because, you see, the plan is I'm going to wait for her in the car, and she's going to run out the building, and she's going to get in the car, and we're going to drive away.
It all worked out, did you?
You know, we used somebody else's car. We told them why we were going to use their car, actually, and everything. But she paints her face, so she's inconspicuous. And she halves up this 5-gallon bucket full of buffalo guts, which she now has the lid off on, and knocks on the door. This very, very kind rancher lets her in and says, excuse me, ma'am, and steps out of her way. and the room is in a trance. Conrad Burns is sitting at one end of the table. He's got his foot on the table, and he's kind of like this. And Ross goes up at the stand, and he's still answering the first and only question so far. And Dan Glickman is there, and his eyes are spinning in his head. He has no idea of what is going on. He has no idea what Roscoe is talking about. And Baucus is there, and he's trying to find out how he's going to make the conservatives think he's conservative and the liberals think he's liberal, because that's all he ever thinks about. They've been lulled into this trance. She gets right to the edge of the table, and somebody screams, "No!" And see, this was her first defense, is that she did not throw the buffalo guts on anybody in the first place. She was placing them on the table. And if the guy who tried to stop her hadn't bumped her arm, they wouldn't have went flying out of control like that. And I'm sitting there in the car, and I have no idea what's happening. The engine's running. It's like, you know, Humphrey Bogart. She's robbing a bank, and, you know, it's Bonnie and Clyde in here. And finally, she comes out, and she has this nice, you know, tall, sort of good-looking gentleman with her, and I'm wondering what's going on. I look at her, and she's lecturing him. She's doing this, and she was lecturing him. She's going, "How could you do this? What's wrong with you?" You know, and he takes her off to jail, and they eventually drove her the living. So I'm not going to go into the whole story. The whole thing was just, you know, it was just a charade from the beginning to the end. I mean, a few highlights. She had an FBI agent. His name was Wolfgang Hockholdinger. And the guy who prosecuted her was Klaus Rickman. And she had these two matching attorneys, whom we referred to as Marcy and Mitzi. And the great thing about Marcy and Mitzi is that her attorney said to her, "If nothing else, you can always appeal on the grounds of having incompetent counsel, because I've never handled a federal assault case before." And needless to say, her first defense failed, and so did all the other ones after that. And, you know, at some point, the jury woke up and declared her guilty. But the moral of the story is that if we ever say we know how we can get by with this, just either accept at that point that you are going to jail. Or, you know, move the campaign in the middle of the night. We don't get up that early in the morning. We probably won't notice it. So that's the Buffalo deal.
I could tell multiple stories, but I think I'll just do this one from Cove Mallard, which was a couple years ago, and a lot of people might not have heard about resistance in the Northern Rockies, but there was a lot of it in the late 90s to the early this century as well. But at any rate, we had done a 74-day blockade of this timber sale, and that thing got busted, and I'm not going to go into that. After that, it got busted, and they started logging the timber sale, which is a corridor between the Gospel Hump and the Wilderness of No Return that is a connecting corridor, and they wanted to build 145 miles of road and log 80 million board feet. So there were a lot of people that were really dedicated to stopping that. At any rate, we had blocked the fella bunter coming in the first day, and this was like a week later, and I think there were only 9 of us there anymore. This idiot cop, Steve Didier, who was extremely nasty Forest Service cop, comes up and introduces us to the new cop on the beat, because they were patrolling the road every single night, that she's going to be on the next night. And so we're like, okay, we'll do an action to block this road. And we kind of followed her patterns of how she patrolled it, and she would go down to Elk City and get a burger or something at like 9 o'clock at night, just when it was getting dark. So we were up above this choke point in the road, and we're like, okay, she's left to go get her burger in Elk City, so we're going to do this. So we send a crew up ahead, and we're doing a tripod with a traverse from two trees underneath it to block the road at this choke point. People go down the road and start slashing it, and there's another crew of us there ready to set up the tripod and two climbers in the trees, and the people doing the arrest are not setting everything up. Like, I'm setting the platform and the tripod. We're about to set this thing up, and somebody comes running back from the slash crew and says, "The Freddies are coming up the road." We start to drag the tripod over to the side of the road to ditch out, and then somebody just says, "We're not going to do that. We're going to block this road." And we're like, "Okay, who cares? We'll put it up anyway." We get together and put this thing up, and we can see the headlights of the cops down the road and our, like, crazy Wild Rockies crew throwing slash directly in front of the truck as it's trying to come up the road. This cop, we can hear the siren. She's got the spotlight out. We get the tripod up, and it's set. And the traverse line gets across, and the people start to go up to the tree to sit in this hammock. And I'm climbing up there to set the platform, do that kind of stuff in the top of the tripod. And the other person is waiting on the ground with their lockbox and all of their stuff. And this cop keeps coming, and people keep throwing logs in front of her. And eventually, when I'm up there, when I'm, like, coming down, she's, like, getting close to the tripod finally. They haven't been able to stop her all the way. And she keeps jumping out of her truck and throwing this slash out of the way. And she's coming forward, and I come down the rope and have him get on it with his Pressix and his lockboxes, and she's about to ram it, so I have to jump in front of her. I'm all masked up, and she gets out and goes, "You're under arrest." And I'm like, "No, I'm not. I'm not under arrest." And I just walk up into the brush and disappear. And at this same point, one of the people with the slash crew suddenly grabs her spotlight and starts flashing it all over the woods. And she totally flips out, runs to her truck, locks the doors, and calls for backup. And when the backup got there, they were very, very upset that this blockade is suddenly in the road. You know, and they're like, "You have to get back 30 feet and get out of the way." And we do this. And then they have her come through to try and identify all these terrible people that were doing all this stuff. And we've, in the meantime, because they waited so long, we've all changed clothes. So she can't recognize a single one of us. And we blocked the road for about 8 hours, and after that action, subsequently the other six cells, after 5 years of resistance, they only did a third of them, were canceled.
And I want to point out, too, that that was like her second day on the job.
Okay, so I've got an action story, because I just did a poem before. And, Asante, you can chime in if I forget something, because you know this one. And I wish Sasha was here, because he could tell it too, but he'll be here later. Anyway, 1989, I believe. No, you don't know. Okay, it's 1989, all right?
89.
Yeah, it was 89. You don't know either. You don't want to say. Okay, anyway, Asante and I decide, okay, our community land trust in the Skagit Valley's falling apart. We're going to go on the road for 6 months. With 2 6-year-old kids in a Subaru with a teepee tied on the top with all the poles, 30-foot poles and a little Subaru. So we take off, and we're going to go on this wild adventure across the Southwest. But first, for some reason, we had to go to Colorado. So this part of the story is based in Colorado. So we go to the first activist conference. Oh, boy. Yeah. Lots of you know this story. So anyway, so we have this activist conference, which is the first ever known convention of Earth First people to discuss major issues of the movement other than a rendezvous. So we don't think anything of it. Like, yeah, whatever. And the feds, of course, are going, the ringleaders of Earth First are all convening, right? So we meet in the schoolhouse, which is kind of infiltrated and bugged and all kinds of things, probably. And we're still not thinking of anything of it, even though we had a vouching system for everybody coming in. Everybody had to be vouched for because what we were discussing was split in the movement and how to deal with stuff. And so at any rate, we decide, okay, as long as we're together, we're going to go do an action together. It'll be fun. It'll be really simple, open, shut door, you know, public demonstration, no big deal. So like a fool, I have my wallet on me with all kinds of information like names and addresses. I will never get over that. But at any rate, we all go to the American Express office to protest a planned ski resort in lynx and grizzly habitat in the San Juan Wilderness, or mountains, essentially. National Forest? Something like that. Between two wilderness areas. Fill in the gaps for me. And nobody has really primed us about the nature of this county, which it turns out is really right-wing horrible, and the nature of where we're going. We just all follow there like sheep, like usual. And we get to this industrial park in the middle of nowhere, and here's the building, and its doors are open, so we assume, okay, it's a public building, we'll just go in and do our little thing. And so we're there to protest American Express. So some people hang out in the lobby and kind of steal their literature and put our literature in. Some women go into the bathroom and write on the walls with bloody tampons. Asante and I had another idea. So we went to the receptionist and said, could we have an appointment with whoever was the CEO? And she said, no. And we said, okay. The stairs are this way, right? So we go up the stairs and she's going, wait, wait, you can't go up there. And we're going, well, we are. And so we kept on going and we knocked on, and we opened, not knocked. We opened every closed door upstairs until we found a board in session. Like it was probably investors. They were all sitting at this board table and there were all these very serious looking people. And we swing open the door and we have this all prepared. I whip out the American Express card my mother gave me and a pair of scissors. And I start cutting it up in front of them. And I give this whole spiel about what's wrong with the investment in the ski resort in the San Juans. And I'm pretty sure they were investors because it was dead silence during the whole thing. And then Asante and I kind of look at each other when I finish our speech like, oops, time to go. So, so we head back downstairs. And meanwhile, there's total bedlam downstairs. And we knew that we'd been asked to leave, but we figured we were leaving, or at least I figured we were leaving. You know, we gave a last howl and I thought, oh, well, that was fun. We go out the front door and I see cops everywhere. And I think, well, this is really impolite of them. I mean, they asked us to leave and we're leaving. So I saw a cop handcuffing this young woman, and I can't believe how dumb I am sometimes. I walk straight up to the cop and I say, you can't do that. So he slaps the handcuffs on me and instantly I have three charges, including, yeah, and Asante saying, no, don't do it. And I suddenly have felony burglary charges, which is kind of interesting since I didn't take anything out of the building. And other people got felony false reporting charges and so on. And so meanwhile, and you can tell part if you want, but meanwhile, while I'm getting carted off, other people are witnessing kind of funny things. Like, first of all, somebody took Sasha, who was only about 6 years old at the time, out of the building, and he has his own escape story. He escaped while his mom got stupidly nabbed. It was Sasha's first escape. Yeah. And at six. And at any rate, they had to force their way into a locked car, asking, because you said you locked it. Okay, you tell that.
Okay, so as Karen's getting hauled away, and I'm going like, damn. She goes, make sure Sasha doesn't get caught. You can't get arrested. And I'm going, shit. So cops are starting to converge and running towards us. So we're running, and they're kind of slow, so it's no big deal. We get to this building, we hide out, and we're watching a couple other people starting running. And one person's just like trying to talk to the cops and run. And so all these cops kind of converge on him, and then they stand in a circle while I watch. He's running in a circle, and the cops behind him, and they're going tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter until like they finally collide in this heat.
Well, he reached out and grabbed his foot. And just yanked.
The cop kind of reached out and grabbed his foot, but they both fall in this tumble. So I think he had probably an assault charge or something.
Yeah.
We're hiding in this thing. These cops are running around everywhere, and we're going, shit, you know, and then some of the other folks show up with a car, and they're like waving us over, so we go over up the other side and say, hey, you want to ride? And they're sure. And meanwhile, other people are still trying to talk to cops. People are getting nailed. There's like 34 of us. 17 people got nailed.
Yeah.
17 people escaped.
Somewhere.
21 escaped? Okay. Yeah. And that's never that period on the numbers. See, and Snaggletooth standing in the middle of the road playing his guitar, singing away. We pull up in the car and we say, come on, Snaggletooth, get in. He was like in the lobby singing away, and now he's out in the road singing away. Everybody's getting arrested all around him. He was in the middle of the song. He didn't want to stop. And the cops are running towards the car. We go like, we try to grab him. And he's like, And so we take off, and he's playing till the cops grab him. And so we split. We go around, get out of there, and we park the car. There's like this big corporate golf course. And so we park the car back in the brush a ways away. And the two of us, Dev and I, come back to see if anybody else needs, you know, to get out of there. So we've got a getaway, kind of. And we find Flynn hiding, and he's like hiding. And then Terry, the woman who did this awesome T-shirt with a skull from back in North Carolina, who had a plane ticket, was supposed to get out of there. She'd been arrested, and she's there with the cuffs on, hiding behind this bulldozer. She walked out of the cop car when the cop went to get somebody else. And we're like, hey, you want to come on? You know, so we give them both a ride out. We go, you know, back across the golf course. That was the only people we could find who weren't nailed. And get in the car. And she's going like, damn, I got to be at the airport. But all my luggage is back there locked in the car. And we're going, shit, you know, we can't go back. But then we come up with this brainstorm idea. We go to the shopping mall. She calls a cab, tells the cab driver, drive her back over there. Talks the cab driver into breaking into the trunk because her luggage is in there. Gets the luggage. She gets back in the cab. You know, cops are still there and stuff, but they just drive through. And she'd been arrested. She's on a plane on her way to North Carolina. You know, like an hour later.
Okay, now I'm back. Okay, so meanwhile, I'm getting carted off to jail, and there's a bunch of us women entering on felony charges, and the fellow women felons think we're just great because they watched it on TV, and they thought it was really right on. So we were doing pretty good. I had, for whatever reason, free access to a phone in the jail cell, so I was giving endless media interviews the whole 5 days I was in. And the long and the short of it is that we initiated a boycott against American Express, and the ski resort never happened. But I wanted to just give a couple short vignettes of the rest of our trip really quick, which are, well, one anyway. I went back and forth and back and forth through court on that one, and $400 later, the judge just said, oh, $35 court costs, and that's it. So that was done. We also went to New Mexico, and one of the highlights of that trip, which is a much shorter story, fortunately for you, is that Manuel Lujan, the Secretary of Interior, was going to speak. And so one of us, who is no longer around the movement, but she was great, beautiful woman, decided, okay, I'm going to dress up for this part. So she put on nylons and short skirt and a blazer and everything, makeup, everything she could really pull off. And she went in to the hotel where Manuel Lujan was supposed to speak. We were outside. We knew what was happening. But outside, they saw us protesting outside. So they put up these big styrofoam blocks so the wealthy people coming to this reception wouldn't have to see us. They would see styrofoam or something. And so she went into the banquet hall before the banquet was supposed to start. And she quietly dropped a vial of, what is that stuff called? Is that Ipecac or what? Butyric acid, and got out of there. And then we went all to a bar later and watched the news. And we watched this one guy coming out of the building. They evacuated all night up to the ninth floor because of the smell, and canceled the whole thing. And so we watched this one guy being interviewed as he came out, African-American guy, and they said, what did it smell like? And he started laughing, and he said, well, if you combined a skunk with dog shit and you made it really strong. So anyway, we had a lot of fun on that trip. We did a little road show and all that kind of stuff. So it was fun.
You've been listening to a special production of Earth First Radio. I'm your host, Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening.